What should you listen to make your Monday mornings that much better? Absolutely Frivolous on CFRC 101.9 FM. We play all kinds of comedy, stand-up, sketch, songs, even poetry, and the occasional interview. Mondays at 10:30 a.m. Tune in or listen to Absolutely Frivolous on our archives page on cfrc.ca.
St. Monday watches over you and me and grants the bone exhausted some liberty.
Broadcasting live from the basement of Carruthers Hall. I say, Carruthers, are you all right down there?
The following program is an all-language show which includes open discussions on topics related to the LGBTQ plus community and beyond, including, but not limited to mature subject matter such as sex and sexuality, personal experiences, and more. We aim to create a respectful and inclusive space for all. Listener discretion is advised. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the producers and this outlet. Stay tuned for thought-provoking conversations and so much more.
Hi, everybody. This is Gino Vanelli. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Today on Rainbow Country, Rough Trade, a tribute to the late, great Kevin Staples. That coming up next, so stay tuned. The Gay Talk Radio right here on Rainbow Country.
Hi, this is Carol Pope.
Hi, I'm Garrett Conley, author of Boy Erased, a memoir.
Hi, I'm Lorraine Segato.
Hi, I'm Gord Depp of the Spoons. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Brand new journey through Rainbow Country. As I like to call it, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. And as always, I am your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm producer and host, Mark Tara. By the way, Rainbow Country originates from CIUT-FM in Toronto. Well, thanks to you tuning in, streaming, downloading. But ultimately, listening. Together, we continue to build Rainbow Country into a nationally syndicated gay radio show, as well as being a number one LGBT podcast. So today, Rough Trade, a tribute to the late, great Kevin Staples, co-founder of the groundbreaking Canadian synth-rock new wave band, Rough Trade. So on this episode, a flashback to my 2020 interview with Kevin Staples and Carol Pope, where we chat about their 2020 induction into the Canadian Songwriters Hall of Fame for their track, High School Confidential. We'll also find out just how they originally met and so much more. Kevin Staples passed away on Sunday, March 23rd. 2025. He was 75 years old. Plus, in hour two, music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. All that lies ahead as we start this journey through Rainbow Country. Our first stop, the Rainbow Country Bookstore. Today, award-winning best-selling author Michael Bach reads from his latest book, Alphabet Soup, The Essential Guide to LGBTQ2+ Inclusion at Work.
Alphabet Soup is a guide that will take you, my faithful reader, on a journey of discovery with the objective of turning you and your organization into active allies, a term I explain in the book. like it or not, LGBTQ2+ people need allies to help us achieve that elusive goal of true inclusion. Everything in this book can be applied to a workplace and engaging with employees, as well as interactions with volunteers, customers, students, parishioners, or just everyday people on the street. When it comes to LGBTQ2+ inclusion at work and in communities, I'm always reminded of one of my favorite conversations. Many years ago, I was speaking with the head of HR for an organization located in a Western European country that shall remain nameless to protect the guilty. She was telling me about the company's work in diversity and inclusion, with no mention of work in the LGBTQ2+ communities. When I probed, she defensively explained that they don't discuss, quote, these things, end quote, at work. I looked over at a photo on her desk and asked if the man in it with her was her husband, to which she responded in the affirmative. It was a wedding photo and she was wearing a white wedding dress, so chances were good. I pointed out that the photo was a statement of her sexual orientation. I likely didn't need to ask her what sexual orientation she identified with because she had it on display. I probably should have asked, but let's focus on the point. That was an eye-opening moment for her. Organizations don't think about how much it costs to not create inclusive space for LGBTQ2+ folks. But the price tag can be quite hefty. There's the cost of lower levels of engagement, the cost of higher levels of voluntary turnover, the cost of recruitment, the cost of decreased innovation. And just like when I enter a wine store, that bill can add up fast. So how do you quantify the cost? I spent a lot of time trying to figure that out. Then, around 2005, someone from IBM shared a model with me. The first time I saw it, I thought, this is exactly what I've been trying to explain. And I used it to build a business case for why my employer needed an LGBTQ2+ employee resource group. At the top of the list of issues is the fact that the approach to educating on diversity and inclusion is traditionally one and done. You put everyone through a voluntary program and you're good, right? This is what I like to refer to as wrong. The first mistake is that your employee population isn't static. The average employee turnover rate is about 18%, but that can be a lot higher in some industries, like food service or retail. One food service employer I worked with had a turnover rate of nearly 75% of frontline workers. By the time you've trained everyone, you need to start back at the beginning to capture new people. And that cycle continues endlessly. Education should be part of onboarding. From the day a person starts, there should be mandatory D&I education, obviously with specific LGBTQ2+ content, driven by a D&I learning map that takes each person through a learning journey. The second mistake in the one-and-done approach is the idea that one program covers it all. If Black Lives Matter has shown us anything, it's that we have a lot of work to do to educate people on anti-Black and anti-Indigenous systemic racism. And that's just one topic. The conversation on LGBTQ2+ inclusion is constantly evolving, and so should your education program.
In the 60s, before the internet, to find each other, queer people needed to actually get together in real space and real time. Since most places didn't tolerate our kind, depending on where you were, your options could be limited. Large cities might have a few specialized commercial spaces, but in the absence of those, it was basically public washrooms, parks, or house parties. They all had their downsides. Commercial spaces required you to spend money, and that's one of the reasons why they were mostly for men. Even in places as big as Toronto, there was seldom more than one lesbian bar at a time. Lesbians earned about 60% of the male wage and probably had more dependents. The economy just wasn't there. The old adage was, gay men go to restaurants, lesbians hold potlucks. Washrooms and parks were also pretty much boys only and could be dangerous, plus parks in the Canadian winter, not so good. You could freeze your willy off. House parties, you needed to know somebody, or know somebody who knew somebody, and so on, and be invited. In terms of commercial life, Montreal had led the pack, developing a sin city reputation during Prohibition in the U.S. in the 1930s. And where there's sin, there's always a place for us. Toronto the Good and Vancouver took a bit longer, but in 1974, Toronto had enough anonymity and a critical mass to produce a small commercial scene. At first, it was mostly straight bars where we were tolerated in a corner as long as we behaved. Next came a few straight-owned venues that served gay clientele. By the mid-70s, a new class of gay entrepreneurs emerged and started to open up on Church Street where rents were cheaper. But not everybody lived in Toronto or Montreal. In smaller centers, where businesses couldn't meet community needs, the lesbian and gay liberation movement of the 70s came up with a new model. Defy economics and do it for ourselves. We might not have a lot of capital, but we did have free labor. For example, the Lesbian Organization of Toronto established a non-profit community center in a ramshackle old Victorian house in 1977. It held dances and brunches and drop-ins and provided meeting spaces and a coffee house and hosted a phone line for a whole generation of women. Loot, as it was known, was following a strategy already developed elsewhere. In Saskatoon, the Zodiac Friendship Society opened its community center in 1973. Edmonton and Calgary soon followed suit. HALO, the Homophile Association of London, Ontario, started in 1974, and the Halifax Gay Alliance for Equality first began running dances in the Turret in 76 and later turned that into a community center. By the end of the decade, there was a network of lesbian and gay groups providing community spaces in dozens of medium-sized centers across Canada, volunteer-run and community-controlled. This is Tim McCaskill, a gay liberation dinosaur from another planet and author of Queer Progress.
Up next, Rough Trade.
Hi, I'm Saida Garrett, co-writer of Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mr. Mark Tara.
Meet you.
You too, virtually. Carol Pope, how are you? Hello.
I'm okay. How are you?
I am well. I always say this, but thank you both for being here to have your voices, your stories be heard by the LGBT community and beyond. So thank you both so much. I am in awe of the two of you because I was telling Kevin Staples this, Carol Pope. And you also know this, but I have your records. I literally have your vinyls for your records, the ones that you pressed and you made on vinyl. Let's start here. Yay, I know. Let's start here. Hall of Fame 2020. You were both inducted into the Canadian Songwriters Hall of Fame for your song, High School Confidential. Congrats. Carol Pope, how does it feel to be a Hall of Famer?
I'm really flattered to be recognized. But also, I think, you know, what took so long, if I have to be honest, because this is a very iconic song.
Why do you think it took so long?
Well, who knows? I don't know. I don't know the workings of, no, I don't know. I mean, maybe people overlook that song, but, you know, I mean, I think it is one of the iconic Canadian songs.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it was trendsetting in a way.
Kevin Staples, how do you feel being a Hall of Famer?
Like Carol says, it's very flattering, and I think for me it's nice to get recognized for the craft of songwriting as opposed to, say, the commerce of selling records. So it was kind of, yes, thank you for that, because, you know, it's nice to get recognized for what you do and what you love to do as far as being a creative person in writing. And songwriting has been, you know, everything for Carol and I for, we've worked together for almost 20 years. And so to get recognized for that was great.
Any thoughts on why it took so long?
I can't speculate on that. If a quick answer would be to say it's Canada. You know, it takes a long time for us to recognize our artists. But, you know, I think I also have to say that that's not why you do what you do, and that's not what you're waiting for. But it is nice once in a while to get the pat on the back. It did take 40 years, but it was worth it. There, nice going there. Too bad you're retired. But, it was still nice to be, it's fine. It's not why you do it, you know. At the end of the day, we knew when we started it was going to be a hard road that we took as far as what we were doing in a pop industry. So, yeah, it was fun. It was good. And I'm glad the song got the recognition. And it's nice to have that bit of immortality, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So can the Society of Composers, Authors, and Music Publishers. In 2017, you both received the SOCAN Classic Award, commemorating more than 100,000 radio performances in Canada for the song High School Confidential. Carol Pope, when you and Kevin Staples were writing High School Confidential, did you have a sense that this track would be different somehow?
Not really. It was originally written, we were working on writing some songs for Cruising, the movie Cruising. You injected stainless steel chrome, moving across town, driving on. Push the speedometer, left the clock tower, move this machine. We submitted it to Jack Nitzsch, who we were working with, and they rejected it. And then I was like, I'm going to sing this, even though, you know, I was thinking that Mate DeVille, who was working on it, would sing it. And then I'm like, I'm going to sing it. So, I had no idea. It just became, just people related to it for various reasons, either because they thought it was, oh, yeah, high school, or they're like, oh, she's singing about a woman.
And Kevin Staples, what are your thoughts on that? Do you have a sense that this was a special song at all?
No. And, I don't know if you ever, when you're writing, you say, oh, this is a really good song, or I really like the song.
But you never know what's going to hit, right?
Yeah, but you don't know what's going to hit. And certainly High School took us both by surprise, I think, but pleasant. I think a lot of it had to do with that it got bleat, to tell you the truth. That gave it a lot of traction, for sure. And then people were talking about it. And the song is quite simplistic, you know, it as far as a song goes, and that's always helps to make things popular. And it's colorful. It's a colorful story. Carol's always had a great, you know, knack for telling a colorful story with interesting twists and turns. So that song has all those elements in it. I think when you're writing it, I have to say, I think for Carol and I, a lot of times when we're writing, we're sort of amused by what we're saying and doing.
We were writing for us, you know, we wanted to make us happy, but in turn that makes your audience happy because they can tell you're in it, you're not faking it, you're for real.
You're getting off on what you're singing about.
Yeah.
So let's go back in time a bit because Kevin, you just mentioned this. So Rough Trade was signed to True North Records. You release High School Confidential. Chum FM contacts you guys to find out if, hey, maybe you might consider altering a line, tweaking, maybe bleeping a line. And the line is, "It makes me cream my jeans when she comes my way." Kevin Staples, what happened?
What happened? Well, I mean, they wanted to play the song. The song was obviously getting, you know, some interest, and they wanted to play it, but they didn't feel they could play it with those lyrics, and they asked if, and they even offered to pay for it. Would we go back in the studio, re-record the vocal, and change that line? And we said, you know, we hummed and hawed, and we talked about it, and then Carol, we decided to, okay, we'll do it, and we went in and tried various ridiculous things to come up with to say, and which we thought was amusing, but then in the end we said, you know, nobody seemed to think what we were doing was really that funny.
We were amused.
Yeah, we were amused by the alternative lines, but so we said, well, let's just bleep it. And, you know, I'm going to go 40 years later, and they were still asking us to do that when we got the award.
Yeah.
They wanted to broadcast the song. They wanted us to change the lyrics 40 years later.
Really?
We just told them, no, we'll keep it the same, but you can bleep it. Because that's really, you know, it was just kind of an affront, really. And I mean, even the radio station making that offer was kind of ridiculous. So we just put a giant, you know, in the middle of the song. Which, you know, again, you know, it's like, wow, that's just making the song even more popular. And
more provocative. Like, what's she saying? What the hell is she saying?
What did she say? Anyway.
And Carol, was that commonplace back in the day for a radio station to say, hey, can you
I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I mean, we did that song. I don't know what happened on the Junos. Did they bleep the Junos? I can't remember.
No, I don't think they did.
That's national television. You know, I don't think so. And we actually did that before it was recorded. So that when we played that song on the Junos, that song hadn't even been recorded yet. Mm. So.
And Chum FM ended up playing the bleeped out version.
Yeah, they
played. And then that takes off.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. And I think they now, I mean, there was a point when they started playing it unbleeped when it became, I don't know, who knows. It was a few years later that they were okay to play it. But here, 40 years later, still asking for that. It's kind of weird.
I know. Yeah, who are we? I mean, we're not like we're some rappers or, you know, it's not like we're really saying anything obscene. It's so tame. It's so tame.
Yeah.
Cream. What is wrong with Cream? Did they play that Prince song, Cream?
It's the imagery, Carol.
Oh, okay.
It's so provocative.
And because it's about female ejaculation. That's exactly what it is. Female empowerment and female ejaculation.
And what's wrong with that?
Nothing, but people can't handle that. They can't handle the idea of a woman, you know, getting off that way. So
the two of you started off in a folk group called O. You then became the Bullwhip Brothers. By 1973, you were Rough Trade. Okay,
there's a sadomasochistic thread here.
So here's the question. Kevin Staples, how did you meet Carol Pope?
How did I meet Carol? I was playing with two crazy European guys, one that was a piano player and a violin player, and we decided after dropping acid many, many times that we should form a band. So we needed a singer because none of us could sing. So somebody decided to set up auditions. And I swear to God, I don't remember anybody else but Carol. And she showed up with her guitar and her hair draped over her face. And she was and proceeded to play these songs, which I just thought were amazing. And I left those two crazy European guys and said, I'm going to hang out with this person. And we got together and started writing songs, and then we lived together for a few years, and, you know, history was made. But I just remember thinking that when I first heard her sing and when I first heard the lyrics to the songs that she was writing, that I thought that she was really someone really special, and made a big impression on me as a young, impressionable, acid-ridden child.
Man-child.
So, Carol, was there chemistry from the get-go then?
Yeah. I thought Kevin was really amazing, interesting person. He was a little bit androgynous. He was beautiful. So, well, if that was appealing.
As well as musically.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, because we spent a lot of time talking about music and seeing music, going to hear music.
Yeah.
So the songs that Rough Trade created, that you guys created, were political in nature, pushing the boundaries of sex and sexuality, even covered by some iconic celebrities, music icons like Dusty Springfield, even Tim Curry, probably best known as Frankenfurter in the iconic film Rocky Horror Picture Show, did a cover of Birds of a Feather in 1978. Springfield covering your music and Tim Curry?
Tim Curry, that happened through Bob Ezrin, because we were friends with Bob Ezrin, who was producing Tim. And
it's a great version.
Yeah, yeah. It is really good. And it was just great hanging out with him, and I went to see him in Amadeus, because he was on Broadway in Amadeus. He was just a fun, brilliant person. And then Dusty, I was involved with her, so that's how that happened. And she actually sings on one of our tracks with my late brother, The Sacred and the Profane. Dusty was a brilliant artist, a very innovative artist, who had to go through a lot of shit to get her stuff recorded the way she wanted. You know, she knew exactly what she wanted. She was very meticulous about, you know, every word, every note that she sang. It was great to work with her.
You know, her version of I Am Curious, the song that she covered from you guys, reminds me of Prince. It's very Prince-esque. I love it.
Oh, we wrote that for her. We just wrote that specifically for her.
Really good.
Yeah.
And Kevin Staples, thoughts on Tim Curry covering you, Dusty Springfield covering you?
It's always flattering when somebody wants to perform your songs, first of all, and to have those people want to perform them is even better. Tim was such a theatrical person. He really appreciated Carol's theatrical sense and the songs. He also did Grade B movie, didn't he do Grade B?
I think maybe he did. Yeah.
Didn't he? Or maybe I'm mistaken. But
Did
Grade B movie. That's
yeah. Right. Yeah.
And Dusty, Dusty's special, and she appreciated songs and songwriting, and she loved Carol, and she loved what Carol was saying. For me, that moment of being in the studio with her, and it was just the two of us, was really a special moment for me, and I just, it was one take, and it's flattering, it's very flattering, and Nona, our work with Nona was really special, too.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. I mean, they did a theater show here at Buddies in Bad Times years ago with six women, and they did all our songs, and it was just the piano and the ladies singing their song, and it was just really great to be able to hear them from that perspective, because you're so used to being inside that box, and then to have that ability to look at it it's nice. It's very nice. What can I say? It's just very flattering, and also really gives you a perspective on the writing that you didn't have before.
So let's talk about opening acts. New York City, Danceteria, REM opened up for Rough Trade.
Yeah.
Who wants to tackle that one?
That was Jim Ferrat, right? It was the reopening, I think, of Danceteria.
Yeah.
It closed and then it reopened, and Jim was running the show, and Jim was a fan. REM, I vaguely remember, as being a good band. And
yeah, I don't even remember if we talked to them or anything. I wish I had.
But people ask those questions, have been asked this question before, and I have to say, at least for me, that I sort of was with blinders on a lot of the time with respect to our career, and kind of, unfortunately, didn't pay a lot of attention to what was going around. And so people say, like, what was it like in this era? I don't know, I was just looking at, self-centered, right? And in a way, I kind of regret that I didn't take in a little bit more of that stuff. But it was great to be playing in that club, in that reopening of that. And Jim was such a fan. It was really an exciting time.
And yeah, I mean, just and Diane Brill and Rudolph, who ran Danceteria, they were such larger-than-life characters, especially Diane Brill, who I'm friends with on Facebook. And Jim, who I'm still, I see him in New York sometimes. he's still like radical. Because I think he was at Stonewall. I mean, he's a really interesting character. And then he became a record executive after Danceteria at Mercury.
On that note, we'll return after this Rainbow Country update.
Hi, I'm writer Adam Smith, author of Deep Sniff, A History of Poppers and Queer Futures. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Hi, I'm Jamie B of TGCD Style Toronto, and I'm a professional feminization makeup artist and stylist providing male-to-female transformations and mentoring to those who identify as a cross-dresser or a trans woman. I first heard of Rainbow Country and Mark Tara in trying to find a radio station that specifically caters to the LGBT community, and I'm so grateful I found this station. It's crucial having a platform like Rainbow Country that welcomes all aspects of the queer community, including allies like myself and what I do. It casts a spotlight on specific needs and interests of human beings, ensuring that people from all walks of life are being validated. It's a real privilege to be able to work with cross-dressers and trans women by helping them align themselves with their feminine energy through the glorious feminization process. So, I want to thank Rainbow Country and Mark Tara for providing this platform for all of us.
If you, or maybe someone you know, would like to be a guest on Rainbow Country to get the word out about an upcoming project, maybe you have an interesting story or journey to share, well, simply head over to marktara.ca where everything is connected and send me an email. It's just that simple. And you too can have your voice and your story be heard coast to coast.
I'm Brian Bradley, author of Outrageous Misfits, female impersonator Craig Russell and his wife, Lori Russellidi. You are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
For Rough Trade, talking about opening acts, Carol Pope and Kevin Staples, David Bowie. Rough Trade opened for David Bowie back in 83. Carol Pope, talk to me about this, because you write about this in your best-selling book, Anti-Diva.
How did that happen?
The promoters.
Oh yeah, CPI.
The family that's been, I can't remember their name.
It was that guy. Yeah. But Bowie obviously knew about us and
he liked you guys.
Yeah. But the first time, our first gig with him, he was standing on stage watching us. And that's the only time I really got to talk to him. But anyway, it was just like really thrilling to be on that tour. And he was really sweet and, you know, an amazing person, amazing talent. And we hung out with his band all the time because we knew them. What else, Kevin?
It was my honeymoon.
Oh, yeah.
Because Marilyn and I got married on the 1st, and then we were playing with Bowie on the 3rd of September in Toronto, and then we played in Winnipeg and also in Vancouver. Yeah, it was a thrill. It was great. We didn't want it to end. It was a little like fairy tale, and we wanted to run away with the circus, you know? When they left Vancouver, they were going to Japan, I think.
No, and they asked us, they wanted us to go with them to Australia and all of that, but we didn't get tour support from...
from your record company.
Yeah. So that was very disturbing and sad. And
why do you think they did that, Carol? The record company?
Oh, I don't think they were looking at the big picture and, like, you know, spending money. You know, investing in that would have been great for our career and great for them, but I don't know. It's Canada. I'm going to just say Canada again.
It's C-A-N-A-D-A. No, I think also it's, I mean, I think for the record company, maybe, you know, they just, like Carol said, they didn't really feel that Rough Trade was worth investing in. We're kind of a novelty act, I guess, for them. But it would have been fun for sure to complete that tour and go play some more dates. Because the audience was very receptive, at least in Canada. We had plenty of fans in the audience, so it was great. It was great to play to those.
And we did tape that TV special, and I've never been able to find the R part of it. I mean, I've seen the Bowie part, but I'm trying to figure out what network that was on, Prime or something?
I'm not sure.
It doesn't exist anymore, whatever it was.
Right.
And I would love to find it.
And the bass player in Bowie's band was Carmine, and he was working with Nona, and was on the records that we had done some, you know, when we were working with Nona, I had met Carmine in the studio, and we met him at his house, or at her house. And so he was already a fan too, which was nice. Mm.
Thrilling.
Yeah, it was. It was great. The band was great. It was a great band. And the band that we had was a really good band. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. And I still have Earl Slick's guitar pick that I picked up from the stage because I use that to write all my music with. it still works.
So Rough Trade recorded 6 albums, 4 gold albums, 1 platinum, 1 double platinum album. After the group disbanded, Kevin Staples, you had a successful career creating music for TV, for film. When you're creating music for television, for film, when you're creating a pop song, are you approaching these things differently, or is creating music? It just happens.
It's a bit of both. So I mean, when you're... it's a bit of both. The difference is that with Rough Trade, the creative process was pretty free of boundaries in the sense that, you know, you could go anywhere and explore any option because you had nobody sort of looking over your shoulder or no guidelines. And then after that, everything after that was basically you're more of a craftsperson. You're being hired to create something that fits a certain set of parameters, especially if you're working in commercials and you're doing commercials for a product, you're in a lot of confined spaces of what you have and what they want, and you're basically providing that. So it's a little more being in a service industry. The same, and then if you're working with a film project, you might have a relationship with a director that's a little more looser and creative, and in which case, then you have some more latitude. But certainly not the complete freedom that you would have, obviously, writing for yourself and also writing, you know, you have complete control over what you're doing, or at least the record company gives complete control. So there's a lot more freedom, but the process of creativity is always the same. You're just trying to mine that channel of energy and inspiration that's inside of you and get it out. But the parameters are different, certainly.
Earlier I mentioned in 2017 you both received the SOCAN Classic Award, commemorating more than 100,000 radio performances in Canada for High School Confidential. In 2020, you both were inducted into the Canadian Songwriters Hall of Fame for the song High School Confidential, a Canadian classic that has, I think, truly stood the test of time. Kevin Staples, when you sit back and you think about that song, a Canadian classic, what comes to mind? What do you think about the fact that you created this?
Well, that song has such, you know, it has such great legs, and it's just been, you know, it's always fun to play. It's always fun to perform. I think the biggest...
And it gets licensed a lot.
It's licensed a lot. Makes
some
money.
A lot of movie fun.
I think one of the things...
it makes money.
One of the things that happens a lot that I do like is that I'll run into people that come say, you know, I was a kid when I heard that song, and it really made a big difference to, you know, my being comfortable with myself, in a sense, or coming out, or to be knowing that there was other options, or just kind of, I don't know, kind of being an affirmation for a lot of young people. And that always makes me feel really great, although it certainly wasn't anything that I was thinking about while doing it. It is after the fact has been a big part of what made that song more meaningful to me, you know, aside from everything else that's happened with it. That seems to be something that is quite often, you know, I'll have people tell me that. And I think that's really great. And I feel really, you know, proud of that. In fact, that's one of the things I feel most proud about Rough Trade, It's just that, you know, that we did give people that freedom, I guess, to just feel that, you know, things were okay. And we were just having a lark in many ways, but the politics of the situation were, you know, when I look back on it, it was a pretty strong stand that we took. And a lot of people got some positive energy out of that, which is great. It makes me not regret all the crap that you sort of tend to forget over time. And then and not feel quite so frustrated by the fact that we never really attained the kind of, you know, notoriety that we perhaps wished we had. So there is a payoff there. And that song, you know, 40 years later, like you say, the last two times that we've recorded it in the last year, it's just sounded great. It's just really sounded, and I don't mean to say that, like, you know, I'm not being, I'm just saying it sounds good. And it's, the song still has great, pith, even today.
Mm-hmm. And Carol Pope? Creating this song that has stood the test of time. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's anthemic, as I said before. It's a very visual song. You can see the person walking down the corridor in the high school. I think I wrote it kind of based on
creaming their jeans.
No, I'm like watching all. You know, I'm a watcher. I love to watch people, and that's how I write. And I think I was partially inspired by this blonde bombshell that went to my school, and also Craig Russell also went to my school, and I didn't really know what to make of Craig Russell because I'd never seen anybody like him. But yeah, he went to my high school. And also I was like, oh, I love, later on I was like, I love drag queens. I mean, I was, you know, we used to go and see drag queens all the time. A drag queen gave us one of our big breaks, Mama Cooper, Murray Cooper, who used to play downstairs at the Colonial. And he also had a club called Mama Cooper's in the 70s.
A dance club?
Yeah. I remember like battling drag queens. I remember a bunch of battling Supremes. There was like three sets of Supremes beating each other up. I don't know. I think all of that inspired me.
Well, I have to say, this has been such a pleasure, such an honor. Like I said at the beginning, I have your vinyl. I have your records. And I was saying this to Kevin Staples earlier. I think that's one thing that's missing in the digital age is the ability to have something like 12 inches by 12 inches, an album, and to have the artwork and the inner sleeves and the artwork that you guys did for your records. Weapons comes to mind, the imagery on that. Fantastic. Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, that was general idea. No, because they worked on most of our album covers, and they're amazingly talented artists.
And I think that art is missing in this modern era when it comes to music and people releasing, you know, digital music, singles, MP3s, that sort of thing.
But vinyl is really, really popular. It's more popular than CDs right now. And cassettes are really popular for some ungodly reason. But I still have some. And they sound pretty, I was playing them and I was like, these don't sound that bad. No. The ones that will play because they don't stand the test of time.
No, they do sound good. Vinyl is good. Scratches and all.
Yeah.
It's real, baby.
Kevin Staples, thank you for your time. Carol Pope, thank you for your
time. You're welcome.
Thank you, Mark. It's great. Nice to meet you virtually.
She's a cool blonde scheming bitch. She made my body twitch. Walking down. confidential. She drives a candy pink, a Cadillac. If I don't get her soon, I'll have a heart attack. When she passes me a look, I wanna burn my books, give up high school. Well, I went, I went, I went to high school, a high school confidential.
Was my 2020 interview with Carol Pope and, of course, the late, great Kevin Staples.
Bill 7, to ban discrimination in employment, government services, and housing based on a person's sexual orientation was up for a vote at Queen's Park. Most NDP and Liberal MPPs supported the bill. But without some progressive conservative legislators backing, a divisive split could rack the province. Four PCs decided to break party ranks to vote with their conscience and support Bill 7. Cabinet Minister and MPP Dennis Timbrell did it to show solidarity for his beloved brother, the well-known drag queen, Rusty Ryan. And for me, a gay politician who was not yet out, I had to take a stand. We were known as the Gang of Four. I'm former Cabinet Minister and MPP Phil Gillies. The date, December 2nd, 1986, when LGBT rights came to Ontario.
Hi, I'm singer-songwriter Steve Grand. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Taking us to hour two of Rainbow Country. Rough Terrain, Shaking the Foundation.